It's alright. It's alright. Here comes the sun, it is not enough. Here comes the sun, I say, it's alright. It's alright. Little darling, it's been a long, cold and lonely.
So, hey, everybody. Welcome to Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement-building show. This is Eric Mann, the host. Channing Martinez is our producer. And I'm very excited to be back on the line with Candy Mossett, one of the lead organizers of the Indigenous Environmental Network. And many of us and you, listeners, know Candy was with us for four straight weeks during the Standing Rock struggle, and it was terrific to have you as a regular kind of revolutionary reporter from the scenes. So one thought I have, Candy, is that maybe we'll start with Standing Rock, because one of the things that happens is that there's big struggles. They get a lot of attention. Everybody's talking about it. And then for a variety of reasons, obviously, the end of the Obama administration, the Trump administration, the changing of the deal. And then even with my own consciousness, I get a little lost and we move on to something else, but the people there don't move on. They're there.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you tell us, from the time that President Obama issued the order to the present, what's been going on?
How long is this show?
Exactly. Well, we're going to do a series. This is a 9-hour series, so
okay.
We can start.
Well, great. Just first of all, thanks for having me back on, and just thanks for all you guys do, getting the voices out there. It's much appreciated, and Happy New Year to everybody that might be listening, and hopefully we're going to, you know, regroup and continue to do what we do, and that is, you know, push back against injustices that are occurring in our communities, like in North Dakota. Just because the pipeline issue isn't in the media anymore doesn't mean that we're not still fighting right there in the Bakken, where the oil is continuing to be extracted in my community. We, you know, have had ups and downs. It's really been an emotional roller coaster with this pipeline fight. But I have always said along the entire time, the pipelines are, you know, simply a symptom of the greater problem, which is the extraction of the oil itself in the hydraulic fracturing that's taking place, the fracking in North Dakota, the flaring. We're still fighting, you know, to basically keep it in the ground and keep our babies safe and healthy, which is not happening as a result of the industry. And so the fight is still on. We had a water blessing and healing walk in Fort Berthold, which is where I'm from, Mandan, Hidatsa, Rikaraw Nations in North Dakota. We have been creating awareness about the sacredness of water and continuing to do a toxic tour and show people that had no idea. They think of a pipeline, but they didn't connect that to where the oil was coming from. And we've been working with landowners. We've been working with people that have had other pipeline fights. As you may or may not know, the Keystone XL pipeline fight also came back up in this administration, because number 45 is just gung-ho on destroying what he can, is what it seems like from my perspective, where he just really doesn't know what he's doing, maybe, if I want to give him some slack. But we're also fighting the Keystone XL pipeline. We have another lawsuit in court. You know, and that's something where we thought we had a victory. So the work continues in the sense that as long as people are being impacted in communities by extraction, we don't have a choice but to make our voices heard, because we're tired of being sick. We're tired of being people that are just pacified by some buckets of money while these oil companies go on relentlessly doing what they want. And that's what it seems to be in this Trump administration.
Well,
and so I'll go ahead.
Well, one thing is that Candy Still, as an organizer, campaigns have ebbs and flows. You know, victories, victories lead to often either higher morale. Sometimes victories lead to people saying thank you very much and they move on. Tell us more about the structure of both IEN and the structure of the Standing Rock organizing work. What does it look like on the ground, besides the oil on the ground? What do the people look like on the ground? What structures? Who's meeting? Tell us, take us inside your movement a little bit.
Well, I think people need to understand this big picture historical context of the movement. Standing Rock, to me, in many ways, was almost a success because of the fact that it woke a lot more people up. It got a lot of people thinking about the reality and hardships that some of us do face, even if we live in the United States, which is supposed to be the place people go for the American dream. And we're telling people the reality around some of the things that happen here, especially to reservation communities and Native Americans, American Indians, whatever you want to say, to our people in this country. And so that has been effective, I feel, in many ways. Am I angry and sad that there's oil flowing through the pipe? Yes. But the Indigenous Environmental Network has been in an official organization since 1990. Prior to that, we were born out of the American Indian Movement, which at that time it was having some problems. There was some breakups and people wanting to do different strategies, which is okay. There's different ways to get to something. I don't believe that there's a one-size-fits-all band-aid to figure out all the idiosyncrasies of humanity, because when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, we are at the base of the problem. And so it's understanding not just what we want to stop, but what we want to work towards. And so my position within IEN is working on just transition, looking at extreme energy and how we transition from that extreme energy. And people have asked me, well, when is it going to happen, or how do you see it starting? And I'm like, it already has. We are transitioning. It's just not quick enough for me. But again, as humanity, we have egos. My lifetime, whether I live to be over 100 years old, is still nothing. It's a blink of an eye, Earth time. So I look at it in terms of, what's that little ripple effect that I'm going to have? Or what's our organization going to do in this time span of a lifetime, for example, that's going to affect centuries, generations from now? We have to be cognizant and aware that there is a certain level of patience that we have to take so we don't burn ourselves out, and so that we're not totally unrealistic about what we can and can't achieve. That being said, I feel like we're in a time in this whole world where people are hungry for that change. And I think that Standing Rock brought that out more than I've ever seen before. There are people that fear change, and that was even brought out. It wasn't necessarily that they hated the idea of having clean water. It was that they were scared. But how do you heal if you don't first recognize and understand that? You can't. So for me, I look at it from that lens and from that framework and perspective to continue to move on and do the work that we have to do, and not just get burnt out and throw my hands up in the air and say, F it, because that's not going to help me. That's not going to help my little baby girl. That's not going to help anybody. And that's what I want to do. I feel like I was born on this planet to do what I can to help as an individual, which is only a little tiny speck, you know, in the grand scheme of things.
Well, I agree with that, too. I want to still go back, though, on a couple of concretes, okay? For instance, and I do agree, by the way, about this sort of, you know, trying to understand the role of time, the role of, you know, where are each of us on this long continuum. You know, I do say that, you know, I definitely have to live to 100 because I got a lot of work to do. My grandmother died at 105, so I have big plans. I do. But the thing is that even then, as you said, it's almost like this endless relay race, you know, that you just get the baton, and when it's your turn, you run and you hand it off, you know. But here's some questions. So I come out of the Congress of Racial Equality, you know, the newer Community Union Project, Students for Democratic Society. And then there was a period, this moment, when the Black Panther Party, La Raza Unida Party, I'm watching this film right now called Symbols of Resistance, about 1973, generally in Colorado, focusing on the Chicano movement. And it's talking about how deeply in 73 they were influenced by Wounded Knee. Mm-hmm. And, of course, for the Chicano movement, to recognize for so many Chicanos and Mexicanos their indigenous roots. So I was there with the Panthers. I wasn't there with the American Indian Movement, but I was there. You know, I mean, I didn't go to Wounded Knee, and I didn't have direct... I had a lot of dealings with the Panthers and with the Young Lords. So here's my question. Here's one question. We know that that was a very exciting period in history. There was the beginning of a Black, Latino, Indigenous, Asian Pacific Islander movement. We also know that there were terrible internal struggles inside the Panthers, inside the Young Lords, people tearing each other apart. Tell us a little bit about what you know, which was before your time, but how do you look back at the American Indian Movement? Have you studied it as a historical situation? Have you read books on it? Have you talked to people about it? How much does that actual experience shape yours? So tell me a little bit about how you understand AIM, in that it was a predecessor to Indigenous Environmental Network. How does it shape your consciousness?
Well, the way I look at it and the way I study and research is I actually talk to the people that were there. I talk to the people that knew people that got hurt. I talk to, you know, the experiences that people had being there, and that's what keeps me going because they're still fighting now. But the thing is like Standing Rock called out what also happens in these movements, why we're divided, because there is that other side that's physically in there that's planting infiltrators, that is making us fight one another, that's putting false context into how we're organizing. And I don't think it was necessarily understood as well back then as it is today. Like, we see the other side, that being the industry, the FBI even, or who it is that has this alternative agenda. And we see that they are using the age-old tactic of the divide and conquer. And we see that during that time, it kind of worked. And what we're doing now after Standing Rock is trying as hard as we can not to let that tactic work. People in our communities are still organizing. We're still getting together and talking about the next fight. We're still saying, well, so-and-so and so-and-so worked with this person. Oh, but they couldn't be trusted because of this, that, or the other thing. We're much more, I think, aware of the ulterior motives that happen in these movements and in the system being infiltrated. We're much more aware of just how evil the other side could be. I mean, even though people knew that it could be bad, that people could get hurt, get shot, it's a situation where people have to wake up to this reality. And it's kind of a heavy burden to bear when you realize that you could actually be persecuted for protecting water. But that is a reality that has been going on since capitalism began. And what I'm trying to get at is that we have to face that. We have to face that and say, no, we are not going to be sheep being herded by some overlord or something, you know. And I love sheep. I'm not saying that, you know, that's a bad
thing. I know,
that's
some of my
thing,
best friends,
you know,
are sheep,
we're not
right.
Gonna, you know, but we're not going to be fooled anymore, have the wool pulled over our eyes, if you will, because we're much more aware, we're much more cognizant of the reality of the situation that we face, which makes us all that much stronger, I think, and able to fight back against that, which we might not even see. I mean, look at Red Fawn. She is in jail still. She is facing charges for supposedly firing a gun, which turned out to be from a guy who grew up on my reservation. He went to school with my older sister. He was an FBI informant that came into the camp and started dating her, and it was his gun that was fired. And she is the one sitting in prison. And it takes me back, you know, to Leonard Peltier. And he's still in there, a prisoner of war, over 40 years for something that I'm totally convinced he didn't even do. And that's the power of the system, to try to scare people into not doing these things. But to scare us into not doing what? To not protecting our water and our air? It's becoming so much more clear how much money power has, and we're becoming so much clearer as individuals how to take that power back. take the power back by teaching our kids where they can go to get water if they can't turn the faucet on. Take the power back by teaching our kids how to garden and grow their own food. If they couldn't walk into a grocery store, would they be able to physically take care of themselves? That is how we as individuals are taking back our own power and saying enough is enough. You can't control us anymore. And I think that the movements leading up to this and Standing Rock happening have only solidified people's necessity to do that.
Well, let's talk. Let's go back. I think that's great. I mean, you said a lot of things. I want to go back on a couple of things. The first thing you said is that when I ask you how you're studying Wounded Knee, you say, well, I'm talking to the people that are still alive. So that involves people like me. You know what I mean? People my age. One reason I think it's really important for me to stay alive for a long time is because there is a historical memory of those mm-hmm. of us who went through a revolutionary period. We have a consciousness that is very hard to convey to others. We saw things, we did things, we took risks. You know, I was in prison for a year and a half. I was in solitary confinement for 40 days. It's nothing compared to a lot of people, but it was a lot for me. And right. we joined the movement understanding death, torture, imprisonment might be one of the options. Then the second thing you said, the issue of infiltration, is very scary stuff. You know, the Communist Party during the 30s, at one point, they would have like 40, 50,000 members, which is a lot. But 10,000 of them would be FBI agents.
Crazy,
right? The American mm-hmm. Indian Movement in Los Angeles, I read, they had an office of 12 people in L.A., four of whom were FBI. So... The thing you said that I wanted to say slowly, if I got correct, that a woman was actually in a relationship with an FBI spy, is that right?
At Standing Rock, yeah. I mean, you can read The Intercept. I think they're on their eighth or ninth version now, the reports that they've been putting out since the camp was cleared, and they've gotten so much inside information, and one of them is that...
No, say, what is an intercept? Help me understand. What should I be reading?
The Intercept is what it's called.
The Intercept?
Yes.
Okay. What is that?
It's a news journal, I guess you could call it, a news outlet, and they have been reporting on the atrocities, the information that they've been able to get, you know, through the... Freedom of Information Act,
right,
the FOIA
right.
requests, where they've been able to find documents that are public information that most people wouldn't go out and just find, but this is what they do. They dig this up, and they've come out with a series of reports that have explained the situation at Standing Rock and how it deteriorated. I mean, we know that Tiger Swan at any given moment had 90 of their own people in the camp posing as water protectors, stirring up the pot, causing trouble. They were bringing in drugs. They were bringing in things that they were trying to, you know, disable the movement. They hired their own PR firm to put a spin on, you know, water protectors being bad. And turns out they were the ones going out and doing all these horrible things and then putting it in the media like it was us. But with Red Fawn, she's, you know, in jail. She supposedly fired a gun, three shots, during a time when she was tackled. She had, like, I don't know, 9 or 10 police officers on top of her, and then you hear these gunshots because there's recordings, there's drone video, but you can't see her because everyone's on top of her. And so she's in jail still. She's been there since October 27th when we were attacked that day. And they dropped charges of attempted murder on a police officer, but they have other charges where they're trying to get her, and she's pled not guilty. And it just recently came out that she was dating a guy from where I'm from Fort Berthold. And Keith Harmon, you know, I might as well say his name. It's out in the newspapers. People know about it. And he actually went to school with my older sister. And I was just blown away that he actually works with the FBI. He went into the camps as an informant and started dating her. And now she's in jail for allegedly shooting a gun that turns out to be his gun as an FBI person. So there's a lot surrounding the controversy around the other side. the police, Tiger Swan, private mercenaries, the oil companies, just how far they will go to cover up how bad they really are to get that bottom line of, you know, money.
No, I think that's really important because I think, I mean, there's so much in what you just said. I mean, imagine the psychological damage to her, you know, besides the political damage that obviously the police informants are very, they're trained. You know, Fred Hampton, the late Fred Hampton, who was killed on December 4th, which is my birthday, so, you know, that's, but he was killed December 4th, 1970. Right before I went to prison. No, I'm sorry. He was killed December 4th, 1969, because I went to jail in January of 70. He was killed because he was drugged by his Minister of Defense. His Minister of Defense was a police agent who gave him a sedative, so he was asleep in his bed when they shot him and Mark Clark. So my point is, it's scary stuff, Candy, and I think...
I mean, have you heard the name Anna Mae Picto-Aquash?
No, tell me about that.
She was killed during the back Wounded Knee days because people were so paranoid around the FBI and that they were so, you know, sure that she was an informant. And they're still muddled. It's still very muddled around it. But this young woman was killed.
Right.
You know, and that's the kind of thing that more and more people are, we're trying to protect each other and know your circle, know who your really friends are and who your, you know, your enemies might be, because it might run a lot deeper. It's still very muddled in the way we live upon the land in our own lifestyles. And it's hard, the lightest footprint that we could possibly leave because of what humanity is doing as a whole. Use and handle money in the way we live upon the land in our own lifestyles. And it's hard. I mean, decolonization is so hard for me, you know, decolonizing my own mind. It's difficult. And, you know, I have a lot of friends that are like, well, we don't celebrate, you know, Christmas, for example, because it's just, you know, a consumerism holiday. And it's, you know, just something to make money. And, you know, that's not even our religion anyways. And that's great. And then I have my family who's like, oh, presents, Christmas. And, you know, the kids are happy. And it's like this big conundrum of how do we do it? How do we walk in this world in a way that is going to be the lightest footprint that we could possibly leave because of what humanity is doing as a whole? And so there's not a one-size-fits-all, which is why I keep saying that. But I feel like people really do need to reconnect, which is the one thing that we have lost as humanity. We've lost respect for ourselves. We would never allow this to happen to the planet if we respected ourselves, the atrocities that are happening. But we've just allowed our minds to be so numbed by outside things, you know, television, and I have to work this 9-to-5 and I have to have a job. And what Just Transition dictates is that we don't have to have a job. We need to have our livelihoods back, where we're actually not just surviving, but we're thriving. And that's something that we're losing. We're losing this battle overall, and we're doing it willingly. We have to remind ourselves where we came from, where we're going to go, and look at all the historical markers to be able to understand what we need to do as individuals.
Well, I think what you're doing is great. Let's stay on the colonizing and decolonizing for a minute. Tell me yours. I'm going to tell you some things I do, and because I've done this now for over 50 years, and I have my own internal colony that I'm struggling with all the time. How do you do it? What's your struggle like, you know, in your own struggle? And then I'll tell you some of the things I try to figure out.
I want to go off grid, and right now it's kind of like it's an expense thing. Like, you have to be able to afford it. And so we're trying to make it more affordable, you know, working with Lakota Solar Enterprises in South Dakota, Henry Redcloud, awesome guy. He came to Standing Rock. They're doing solar panels where they actually teach the people how to make them and then install them so that we're not reliant upon a larger system. We talk about decentralized wind and solar, not big corporate scale farm power.
Right.
That has to do with money, because then again, it just creates the same problems. And so educating people on that and educating myself along the way, my own community members that are right there in the heart of the Bakken Formation, how do I communicate what I know and feel as an individual when it comes to not only the science behind the work, because I have a master's degree in science and environmental management, but how do I communicate in that traditional knowledge sense? Because people feel that still. We have blood memory. And so my struggle is always not overstepping my boundaries as a person who is not an elder, for example, because our traditions tell us, you know, you respect what the elders say, but also understanding there's a whole generation that was lost to boarding schools, that was, culture tried to be beaten out of people. There's assimilation, acculturation, and every day I struggle with the difficulty of understanding why my tribal council makes decisions in the system that they're in the federal system, the government system. It's like we were set up for failure and people aren't really recognizing that. So how can I help educate when people just say, well, just run for office? And I'm like, I can't right now. That's not where I'm at in my life. I don't want to be this politician. How can I do it other than that? With my daughter, last year at Standing Rock, I headed out, and so I had to let my garden die, and I felt bad because I'm trying to teach her, you know, how to garden and stuff. And I don't want to get lazy. I want to make sure that I go and pick weeds and be outside and, you know, that I go and pick choke cherries if I can find them. That's another struggle. You know, Juneberries, like there should have been a lot more Juneberries than there was last spring. And that kind of stuff is really concerning. And so I'm like, well, maybe I need to start actually planting these bushes and these trees. Hello. It seems so simple when you think about it, but it's just the act of doing it and then getting other people to come along with me. And so I think that's been my biggest struggle, is just like, you can't always necessarily afford things, but you can make them affordable in other ways than making it small scale and doing it yourself. We're so reliant on a system right now.
The voice you're hearing is Candy Mossett, an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network, one of the lead organizers at Standing Rock, person with obviously a lot going on in her very fertile, convoluted mind that we're listening to. She's got a lot going on in that brain and soul. The other voice you're listening to is Eric Mann. I'm the host of Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. And the reason I wanted to spend a whole hour with Candy is because what I'm sort of going through right now is I want to go and talk to, 15, 20, 25 of the organizers, intellectuals I respect the most, kind of the long-distance runners, including the younger long-distance runners like Candy, to ask people really what's going on, because I see a profound political crisis in this country way beyond Donald Trump. I mean, way beyond them. Very concerned about the fetish around Donald Trump, because I spent 8 years trying to build a movement to challenge Barack Obama with virtually no success. And we who worked in the Black and Latino community in L.A. But it's even more than that. I'm trying to figure out about socialism and communism and the state of the world. And can I understand what's happening in Iran right now? Can I understand? So on my stuff, like I start out every morning, I do yoga and meditation. It's a very active meditation. I play a drum. I do martial arts. I jump up and down. I don't know what I do, but I do try to center myself before I go out into the world to work through what's going on with me. What kind of demons am I, what's happening with me that I need to work through before I face anybody else? Second thing is I just read voraciously. I read history all the time, including mainly about revolutionary movements, because one of the things, like the stories you told about, and you being very courageous, let's take just for a minute. One is a story of a police infiltrator who got involved and manipulated a woman who was being charged for something she didn't do. The other is a woman who was perhaps killed by the movement under false charges. Now, if you just bear with me for a minute, a lot of people say, well, are you not aware of some of the stuff that the Panthers did? I say, of course I am. Are you not aware of some of the atrocities that happened in Russia? Yes, I am. Are you not aware of some of the atrocities that happened under communism in China? I said, yes, I am. But here's the issue. The biggest atrocity is my own government. See, I don't like this government. I don't like the United States. I am not loyal to the United States, and I hate it. I know the United States dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima. I know what the United States did since 1492. I know about the transatlantic slave trade. So please don't tell me what the Russians did, which I know, or the Panthers did, compared to what? And I think most people in the United States love the United States. No matter what they say, no matter what they claim, people on the left, we are so privileged here that there that people say, well, I left the movement because something happened wrong in the indigenous environmental movement. I said, you didn't expect something to go wrong there? Is that your excuse? That something was done bad to you or somebody did something wrong to you? Where are you going? Back into the United States where you must be happy. So I think, not speaking for you, Candy, but the way, since you're aware of this information, you continue to stay on track because I think you have a better sense of who your friends are and who your enemy is. Is that fair? Is that accurate?
I mean, I would just say that there's no question that we are living in a time, and always have been, where there's good and there's evil, and you can choose which one you want to pamper to. I mean, it's kind of like we are set up to be this way in the United States because of capitalism. They make it very cushy. They make it very easy to turn the other cheek and to not have to worry about those other things. You know, it's something on a spectrum of problems, and, you know, the problems are always, you know, my health care, for example. I would really love to help the movement, but I have to worry about my child that I have to pay for health care.
Right.
Without even looking up the sense of, what about the root cause of that problem? Why is your child sick in the first place? Well, I know, I get what you're saying, but I'm just too busy to worry about it. And we're set up to think that way. Just hold on one second. Can you ask another question?
It's from 901-9234 or 9324.
Sorry, I'm at the hospital. Speaking of which, my little niece, she has Down syndrome, and we're at the hospital right now. She just had to have surgery, which she almost got turned away for because they only have Medicare, and they didn't want to have to pay for this, that, or the other thing. And it's like so many people have to struggle, and it's easy to get in the struggle and not be able to see a bigger picture or kind of feel powerless to do anything about it, really. And that's kind of what I try to do, is like bring back that sentiment of power and say, stop giving your power away. We have so much more power than we give ourselves credit for. We just have to not let the system beat us and burn us out. And we, whatever it is, it's that reconnection. Like you said, you do yoga and you do jumping jacks. I like to go outside and reconnect and be part of what I am. We are all a part of this planet. We're all made up of the elements. Like, we have to remember where we come from. And if people don't feel comfortable saying Mother Earth, that's fine. We say it because that provides for us the way that nothing else can. If we don't have clean air, clean water, and if we don't have food, so clean soil, we have nothing. And we have to wake up to that realization that we're being put in this situation by our own government. And it's because of money, and it's because of the system that they want us to be reliant on, which is what I keep saying. Break outside that box and that system, and we'll be much better off for ourselves.
Well, the thing you were saying, Candy, I mean, it's not an interruption to say, oh, I'm sorry, I have to interrupt my interview on KPFK 90.7 FM because I have a niece. Is it a niece with Down syndrome?
Yes.
And she's being denied possible medical care because they won't take Medicare. That's not an interruption. That's the main thing we're just saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that we interrupt the revolution to have life? No, I mean, life is the core of the revolution.
Right.
One thing that I have felt is I need to see the earth more. I mean it. But I know that the thing that feeds me the most is the people or the masses, that the more I spend time with people in the community, the better is my own consciousness. You know, it's not just yoga and reading, but then who do you see every day?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was an organizer with in Newark, New Jersey, you know, I used to go door to door in the black community and the so-called slums and tenements, and but I'd sit in people's living room all the time and just listen to them, and they would be telling me about their life. And that was a big part of what I liked about being an organizer, was sitting in people's living rooms and that they would let me in, you know, that they wanted, or sitting on people's stoops and just having a drink with them and talking to them about stuff. I want to do more of that. And yes, I want to, you know, for us too often in LA, Mother Earth is a sidewalk covered with a car next to a bus with a billboard and a garbage can and a beer can and a cigarette butt. So that's Mother Earth for us, you know, if we don't. So let's go. You're listening to Candy Mossett and Eric Mann. Let's go some specifics.
Okay.
Tell me about the structure of, are you organizing on a specific reservation or on a specific indigenous community right now? And what is that community and what does it look like? Take us inside as if you were walking down the street or so forth.
So what I can tell you about is what I know best, and which is where I'm organizing and where I'm from. I'm from Fort Berthold. It's called Fort Berthold because it literally was a fort that was built to keep my nations, the Mandan, Hidatsa, Rikara nations, in it when it was first established in 1860.
Right.
And since then, we've been struggling. First of all, they put three tribes on the same reservation. That was a big, huge conundrum that's playing out
right
today in the oil boom. They did the Indian Reorganization Act in 1930, and this was after the Allotment Act in the late 1880s, where they took more of our land. They, you know, our reservation used to be over 12 million acres, but it was seceded by presidential executive orders over the years to where now it's under a million, which in some places that's considered big still. A lot of people don't realize there's about 568 federally recognized tribes in the United States still. It's federally recognized, but we're still, quote unquote, the Indian problem. They still don't know what to do with us, for
right
example, because they wanted
right
to terminate us, you know, and so we're struggling with our culture, our language, and then now oil companies coming in and saying, hey, we're going to give you this money, you're not going to be poor anymore, and so people fighting over money and saying, some saying take it, some saying don't, some saying I don't even have a choice, they took it anyways because I don't own these mineral rights because a bunch of the people are farmers. And I'm struggling with this concept of just transition and how do we transition away from an economy that's killing us, literally killing us and killing our mother Earth underneath our feet. And how do we get people to not get caught up in the capitalistic tangle? And so that's the model, is doing just transition workshops and talking about educational tools that we can use to do our own large-scale gardening. We were farming tribes. Historically, we grew corn and squash and beans. We did not get forced into a cash economy until the 1950s, when again the federal
wow
government stepped in and they flooded all of our class one and class two agricultural lands, creating Lake Sakakawea, which is one of the largest man-made lakes in the United States. You can see it from space. And that lake was created to alleviate flooding that was happening downstream in St. Louis, Missouri. Incidentally, the flooding was happening because the Army Corps of Engineers removed riparian zones and removed wetlands and put up barricades. So, of course, they were flooding. Instead of fixing it there, they came to federal, to reservation lands, starting in Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, down through. They built a series of five dams in the Pick-Sloan Act, or the Flood Control Act of 1944. That dammed all these reservations. Mine was one of them. Standing Rock was one of them. That's why they were fighting to protect Lake Oahe. Again, another man-made reservoir that could become contaminated should this pipeline leak. And so the struggle is so real in that historical context. We've been fighting the government ever since we can remember. There's been an over 500-year struggle that as Native people in this country we've been engaged in. And so that's why I feel like when I look at historical context, we're actually gaining some traction in a sense, because so many more people are so aware of the power that we can have. We are going back to large-scale community gardens. We are going back to teaching our language, which was something that couldn't even be taught when I was little in school. I grew up not being able to even ask questions of my teachers, because if it wasn't in that history book, we weren't allowed to talk about it, even though we were sitting right there on a reservation. I mean, I grew up being told everything was fine. They used to take polls. Are you a Democrat or are you a Republican? And I would be like, I don't know. What does that mean? I remember
right
being like in elementary school. I was like, I don't know. And I remember some of the kids that would be farm kids would be like, oh, we're Republicans because that's what our parents are. And I was like, hey, Mom, Dad, what would you consider yourself? And I remember some convoluted, well, I guess we'd be Democrat. We would never be Republican. I was like, okay, I guess that's what I am. And it's so funny that that's what kids are modeling things after. It doesn't even have to do with the concept or an idea. It's like, well, what do? Okay, that's what I do. And that's how I grew up. I grew up on a reservation. I grew up, you know, being mixed. I'm Mandan, Hiradza, and German on my dad's side. I'm Arikara, Chippewa, and Norwegian on my mom's side. So there was always this conundrum of, well, you also, you know, have lighter skin than other people. What does a Native person actually look like? You know, my grandma wouldn't teach me Hiradza because she used to get beat in boarding school if she spoke her language. She talked about how they would make her drink shampoo until she was ill if she spoke her language.
Right.
So we're still healing. You know, we're still trying to come back from what happened to us. And she said in the 1950s, when we were flooded like that, it was like slamming a door and never being able to go back, because that's when we were forced into a cash economy as Mandan, Hiradza, Arikara people. We were doing fine before that. And then we were forced onto the top ground, the highland, where it's all windblown. You can't grow crops up there good. And so then we got forced into cattle ranching. So you have like a lot of Native cowboys nowadays that, you know, ride broncs and, you know, they get out and ride bulls. And it's kind of like a Native thing in Indian country where you can be a cowboy or whatever, because that's what we were forced into. Then I have vegans, you know, calling me up and knocking down my door, which I have no problem. If a person wants to be vegan and that's their choice, they're telling me it's wrong. What you're doing is wrong. You can't use your culture to say that you're going to eat meat. And that really hurts. It's like, you don't know anything about my culture. I understand that there's could be a problem with, you know, methane gas. But instead of attacking cattle, why don't you attack the industry that's creating these methane, ethane plumes because of fracking? Like, how is it such an offset and such a, you know, and that's the thing. The conundrum is that we're totally unbalanced in the world today. There's totally an unbalance in the way we act as individual humans. We don't have the respect that we as Native people used to have not that long ago. Respect for the land, respect for the earth, respect for ourselves. To always, it wasn't always take, take, take. It was a give and take. Even still, when my brothers go out and kill a deer, they put down tobacco and they say a prayer. And they thank that animal for giving them the nourishment that they need to give to their families, you know? And it's not like trophy hunting. And it's not like all this madness where people can go shoot bears and cubs in their dens now. You know, that's how far gone we've gotten as on that scale. And, you know, trying to bring all of that into focus for people and to understand that that's the problem is a challenge. And also trying to walk a line of my own, you know, trying to walk my own, how do I make it good in my life? How do I as an individual walk on this place? And so there's a lot rattling around in my brain. But in Fort Berthold, where I'm from, Newtown, where I grew up, it's simply looking at the devastation that has been occurring since the oil boom and fighting. Tooth and nail, fighting, blood, sweat, and tears to stop it from continuing to destroy our lands and destroy our people. I don't feel like I have a choice. I don't feel like it's a job. In fact, I don't think a lot of people that do this work feel like it's a job. It is our life. We're fighting for our lives and for the lives of our children.
Well, we're very lucky to have you, Candy. I mean, I was thinking there's so much of sometimes I want to say to you, slow down a little bit, but in your brain even. But I know that part of it is the enjoyment of these concepts and how fast they're moving inside your brain. So, for instance, one of the good things is we're going to send this out for transcript, because I think that the riff you just did, you know, which was like a jazz solo, right? If I can, I just want to slow back and feedback. Is that okay to you?
That's fine.
All right. So the first thing that's phenomenal is history, right? So the question mm-hmm. of, you know, when I read revolutionary history, one of the things you start with is, all right, so, you know, I do like Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's Indigenous People's History of the United States. Do you like it?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, take a drink of water.
Yeah, sure. But do you like the book?
Yeah, I mean, it's on my shelf. And I feel like I have so many books on my bookshelf that I've only gotten I don't read them from front to back. I go in and read this thing and that thing, and I probably shouldn't do that, but
all right, well,
I haven't read that.
Well, we gotta. I'd love you to come to L.A. because I was going to try to deconstruct or reconstruct a lot of stuff you said. So let me just go slow, but you just take. Let me come in for a minute. The first thing I'm getting to is that the history, understanding things in sequence and consequence. So there's 1492, but in 1492, the indigenous people have their own internal contradictions. It's not like they were just all getting along great beforehand, but they never practiced genocide. They never did what the crazy Europeans did. And so she does a very good job in explaining, because she's saying this is not a history of the indigenous people of the United States. It's an indigenous people's history, meaning view of the United States from their point of view, essentially. Mm-hmm. So there's a phenomenal first chapter about just the whole 14,000-year-old, I got to know better, I think it's about 14, 15,000 years, about the Bering Strait and, you know, the indigenous.
Right.
That whole period of how there was 100 million indigenous people from Alaska to the tip of South America. 100 million.
Well, there was more.
There was more. Okay,
there
good.
Probably more.
All right, cool. But if you ask the average white person how many indigenous people were there in the United States, I don't know. But the fact that there was more than 100 million, okay.
I mean, it was, yeah.
Right? The second thing that you were showing is all these horrible, horrible laws that were passed one after another. The issue of putting different tribes on a reservation, that's what the Europeans did in Africa. They would take tribes that had their own issues, and then they would just carve them up into countries that had no relationship to the actual people that were there. And then, of course, the tribes would fight among themselves, which is what they wanted, you know, blah, blah, blah. Then you went into a whole thing about ecology and all the crazy stuff that the United States does to compensate. It's always like one terrible thing they do to compensate for another ecological mess they made, right? So they build a lake because they, say it again, why did they build a lake? Because they had done this other...
Well, there was flooding happening downstream in northwestern Missouri because the Corps took away the riparian zones, the natural wetlands. Okay. And so in order to alleviate that, they came up with this Flood Control Act of 1944 and flooded us out, conveniently because it was reservation lands. There was five dams, five reservations, and it was like we didn't matter. And the country at the time was also still going through, we had the termination era, like literally an era where they tried to terminate us and it didn't work. So assimilation came after that and acculturation, and that was a lot more successful, making people forget who they were.
Yes. And the issue of, so then you went through, which is very vulnerable, and if I could say beautiful, about your own struggle for racial and political and cultural identity. The, you know, the if I can take a risk to say, I think the concept of mixed is very unhelpful, you know, in a genocidal country, because for black people, for Latino, for indigenous people, almost nobody has a completely homogeneous family, you know what I mean?
Right.
But as you well know, you're not mixed up, you know what I mean? You're very clear. if you read in the introduction to Black Reconstruction America, Du Bois said something like there's 30 million black people in the United States. They're all black. Some of them are very light-skinned. Some of them are very 100% African. Some are a combination of European, indigenous, and black. Some are black and black. Some are black and Latino. But they're all black. So when I was in the black movement, we never used the word mixed. It was never heard of. They might say she's a light-skinned sister, or she's got, you know, they would, but it would yeah. never be challenging the racial identity of people, because once you start that, you destroy the racial and cultural unity of the group. That starts looking at each other differently. So you were very beautiful to say that, and then to talk about it as your own journey, right? Your own journey about restoring language, restoring your own racial, cultural, ethnic identity. And
I'm still on that path, you know? There's still really a lot to learn.
Oh.
I'm also a cancer survivor. Throw that in there. there's just a lot that has happened to us, and it's unfair. And I'm just one person. I'm just an individual that grew up in that and wants to change it for the better. That's it. I don't like labels. I don't like being put in a box. I'm not a tree hugger. I'm not an environmentalist. I'm not an activist. Really, why do I have to be labeled? What's this obsession? It's like I am a person who cares, and I love my family, and I love people. I have a lot of love, and I want to go for the good in the world that I see, because there is so much worth fighting for, and there is so much worth protecting.
Well, you're an amazing person, and one of the things I was going to say, Kennedy, is that we're going to take this interview, this conversation, and luckily I'm going to do it, we're going to also get it transcribed, and then my concept is I would send it back to you, and then Channing and I also, and we could type in notes into the transcript. Like, you could look at it and say, hey, I want to elaborate more, that's this, the issue of language, and about, you know, why they would use shampoo, you know, not let indigenous people use their own language. Or I want to elaborate this point, and we could sort of make it into an interesting document where we'd keep the original document in one color, and then you could put your notes in another color, and I could put mine in another color, and we could, like, have a conversation with your conversation. What do you think?
I would appreciate that. I like the idea of that, because then people can delve more deeply into what you could ever learn in an hour call, because there is a lot of historical context to understand where I come from, and I can only speak from my own reality, and I think that's what's really key for people to do, is to speak from their own truth, you know, and speak truth to power, and you can only do that by understanding where, you know, where I can only do that by understanding where I came from, and I can share that with you, and whatever people choose to do with that information, I hope it's good. I hope that they have a better level of understanding about the United States and the problems that still exist in a huge way, especially when it comes to the way Native people have been treated and continue to be treated. The foundation of this country is crumbling, and I think that's a good thing, because it was a bad foundation to begin with. We have to start with a really good foundation and make it right and do the right thing by people, and not some false American dream that was created, which wasn't real. It was built on the backs of people that suffered as a result of getting, you know, more and more and more. And I'm okay with that.
Well,
I'm
that's
okay
what
with that crumbling.
Well, that's wonderful. The voice you're hearing is the revolution. Now, there's a lot of words you say, you know, you don't know if you're a tree hugger, you don't know if you're this. You are a revolutionary, sister, I'll tell you that. So that's my main thing. I know I am a revolutionary. And I'm also an anti-imperialist revolutionary because, but anyway, and I think you are too, without putting a label on you. But I think the thing you said, I wonder, how many minutes we got, Channing? 2 minutes left? I think what you just said is that this country is crumbling. It's falling apart, and that's a good thing, because it was built on such a sick, ugly foundation that that's what a revolution is bringing this whole structure down. But the last thing I'll say, because you get the last word, is all revolutions exist inside the structure of the country they're trying to overthrow. You know, I mean, you don't develop it somewhere on Mars. It exists in Standing Rock. It exists on your reservation. It exists in the black community. What's the most hopeful, in your last minute and a half, to yourself first, what's the most hopeful thought you have about your future and the future of indigenous people?
My hopeful thought is that the future is looking bright, and they can see it through the eyes of the kids that are so innocent and don't know all the corruption, but they are willing, you know, and able to say, I'm going to take this up, and I'm going to learn something new, and I'm going to push forward in a good way. They're so hopeful. You know, I have so many things to be thankful for, and we do as individuals when it comes to, for me, I'm still alive when I shouldn't be. I mean, I had a stage 4 sarcoma tumor when I was 20. I should have been dead.
Wow.
So to me, I feel like there is that reason that people are put here. I really do. I think it's just up to the individual whether they want to tap into it or not. And I don't want people to get stuck in apathy. I don't want people to be fearful or think that it's too big that they can't do anything about it, because that's the easy way out. the much more challenging way is to say, you know what, I don't like something either about myself or about the way I'm living. So, you know what, I'm going to do something to change it. Even if it's as simple as taking that can and throwing it in the recycling bin instead of throwing it in the garbage. Even if it's this little tiny minute, seemingly minute thing, that could be the step in the right direction for people to make a change. Grow some herbs in your windowsill. Grow some tomato plants out on your balcony if you live in a city, but don't be afraid to do that little something.
Well, I think that the revolutionary indigenous gods would not let you die. You're too valuable, Candy. We need you too bad. And you are so stubborn anyway. You weren't going to let it happen. You are such a pain in the ass. You probably said, nah, I'm not going to do this. I'm not into dying. So we're very lucky to have you. We're very lucky to have you alive. The movement really needs you. You have a beautiful life force. And we look forward to continuing the conversation. And we're going to have you back on Voices from the Frontlines very soon.
I appreciate that. Thank you for all you guys do and getting the voices out there. Matsigarad.
You take good care of yourself, sister.
You too.
So this is Eric Mann. The voice you heard, the beautiful voice you heard, is Candy Mossett from the Indigenous Environmental Network. We're so lucky that she's alive. We're so lucky that she is a friend of Voices from the Frontlines. You heard her a lot last year in Standing Rock, and I see you're going to be hearing a lot more in 2018. On behalf of Channing Martinez, who's not just the producer, but today was the engineer for the show, I want to thank everybody. We'll see you next Tuesday at 3. All power to the people. All power to the Indigenous Environmental Network.
Good afternoon for the KPFK Newsroom. I'm Dan Fritz with the daily 4 p.m. news headlines. Flash flood warnings are in effect for Ventura, Los Angeles, and other nearby counties as the second day of a predicted two-day storm pelts the region. Flash flood warnings have expired for Santa Barbara County, but mudslides have already taken their toll with at least 8 people dead and dozens injured in Montecito. The massive Thomas fire last month left the area more vulnerable to mudslides. Waist-high mudslides have left rescue crews scrambling to search for survivors. Nearly 7,000 residents in Santa Barbara County were given mandatory evacuation orders. More than 30 miles of the 101 freeway has been shut down because of the flooding and debris flow between Santa Barbara and Ventura. The 5 freeway was briefly shut down this morning near Los Feliz after a big rig rolled over. One person was killed. Evacuation orders are still in effect for parts of Burbank hit with an early Tuesday morning mudslide. A natural gas leak has been reported in Burbank, prompting more evacuation orders on Country Club Drive. Evacuations were lifted this morning for areas burned down by the recent creek fire in Cagle Canyon, Lopez Canyon, and Little Tahunga Canyon. LA fire officials are warning residents in Lakeview Terrace and Sunland Tahunga that evacuations could be ordered due to the threat of debris flows. The CHP is reporting all lanes on the 170 freeway are closed in both directions at the 101 in Studio City due to flooding. LA County supervisors today denounced drastic cuts in federal funds for the prevention of teen pregnancy. The supervisors are drafting a letter to oppose the premature ending of a $10 million 5-year teen pregnancy prevention program. And a major wage theft case has resulted